it in. One of the targets was a quarry in enemy lines, of course, and the Air Force, basically Canadian Air Force, had that target, that quarry as a target, and they came over to bomb it. Well, it just so happened that my battery happened to be deployed around and in another quarry to the northwest, and the Air Force unfortunately found the wrong quarry and bombed our battery instead of the enemy. This sort of thing does happen at times. Artillery fire sometimes falls short, and sometimes mistakes are made in selecting targets from the air. But it was a serious, pretty serious offense. Not only caused great damage to the battery, which was out of action for 24 hours, but also caused some damage to a medical installation, and I can't remember whether it was a field ambulance or a field dressing station, just across the road, on the other side of the road from us, where they had their white, their crosses laid out in the field and everything, but bombs did in fact fall on them, and they had a lot of trouble as well.
To your knowledge, were there any repercussions from that particular incident?
Yes. Air Marshal Cunningham, who was, I'm not sure what his appointment was in those days, obviously something to do with the bomber side of air operations. He happened to be standing on the edge of the quarry the day this happened. He had come down, as we were told, to observe the bombers going in and doing their job, and then our own troops following up. So he saw the whole thing, and the story we got, and whether it's true or not, I have no idea, was that because of what happened, a number of Canadian pilots were returned to Canada for disciplinary disposal.
Were you yourself injured at all?
Oh, when you could, very slightly. We could see these Liberators, and that's what the aircraft was, going overhead, and they were flying very, very low. And we'd see them flying over, and we assumed they were going further on to attack the enemy. And then you'd look, next thing you'd look up, and you'd actually see the bomb bay doors open, and then you'd actually see the bombs coming out through the bomb bay door. And then they'd be heading, the bombs would be heading down towards your battery position. So everyone scurried for cover. I remember I personally crawled under my vehicle, but the bombs landed very close to the vehicle and actually lifted the vehicle right off its four wheels and turned it over. And the rubble was flying all over the place, and a piece of rubble hit me on the head, and I got a small nick, but it was nothing. But there's a lot of people seriously injured. I remember one young boy who drove our water wagon. Got one leg badly hit, and I rushed over to the medical post where the doctor was, and his leg was in such bad shape that the doctor had to cut the leg off, amputate it before the boy left, and the boy was, his spirits were tremendous. After he lost his leg, he was conscious, and they were taking him away on the stretcher, and he said, he waved to his friends and said, "See you in Blighty." And that took a lot of guts, I found. But we lost guns, we lost vehicles, and we lost soldiers. So we were, in fact, out of action for 24 hours. But I was impressed with the Canadian supply system, because within 24 hours, we had reinforcements, personnel. We had new guns coming up to replace those that were knocked out. And we had new vehicles up, which replaced the vehicles that were knocked out. And that's where we lost most, were our vehicles. I'm not sure what percentage it was, but we lost an awful lot of vehicles. But within 24 hours, we were back on the road, and we caught up with the rest of the regiment. And we're back in action in 24 hours, which I thought was pretty good. So then the battle continued slowly down that road, and eventually, of course, after many days of hard fighting, there was a link up with the Americans who were coming up from the south. An interesting aspect from the artillery point of view there was that as the two armies got closer and closer together, the danger of, say, Canadians firing into American lines, or vice versa, the Americans firing into Canadian lines, became a real problem. So what was done to solve that problem was to select an arbitrary no-fire line somewhere halfway between the two of us, and the Americans couldn't fire north of that line, and we couldn't fire south of it. That solved the problem. And as far as I know, there were no casualties as a result of that. So eventually the gap was closed, and many, many German troops were enclosed in that gap, caught and trapped in the gap, and there was an awful lot of carnage. Gosh, I can remember seeing broken carts and dead horses and dead soldiers and smoking vehicles, the things you would expect to see as a result of a battle like that. If you can imagine two armies coming together like that, with a third army trying to get out between the two, there's got to be an awful lot of carnage.
Did you have occasion to see German prisoners or
no,
at all?
I did not, because when the gap was actually closed, I was not doing forward observer. Again, I was back with my battery.
I was just wondering what their morale would have been like.
Pretty shattered, I was told, but no, to answer your question, I didn't see them personally, no. So the gap was closed, and then the next stage of the battle, we all turned to the east and northeast and headed along various routes until we got to the Seine, where we were delayed very, very briefly. And eventually we crossed the Seine. I wouldn't think we were delayed more than 24 hours, but I honestly can't remember exactly how long. It was a short delay. And we crossed there, and then the various formations, 3rd Canadian Division, the 51st Highland Division, the 2nd Canadian Division, took off in various routes and were given certain objectives. As far as the 2nd Canadian Division, of course, we were allowed to go back to Dieppe, where they'd had so much trouble before, and they went back into Dieppe. The 3rd Canadian Division was on their right, and we went off and ended up on the coast at Le Tréport, and then carried along the coast to the Boulogne area, where some of our division went in there and cleared that out, but not our brigade. And then we ended up in the Calais and eventually the Dunkirk area, where we had some fighting, which lasted for several days, but nothing too serious. The Germans did decide to try and fight and hold those two coastal ports, but eventually they were rooted out. And then we carried on along the coast, and finally we were stopped, and stopped seriously along the Leopold Canal. The crossing the Leopold Canal is likely one of the likely the stiffest part of the fighting that I had seen during the war, I would say, because the Germans were determined that they were going to prevent us from using capturing Antwerp and making use of the Scheldt estuary, which led into Antwerp. And Antwerp, of course, was a big port that the Allies were determined they had to have. So the Germans were determined they were going to prevent us from doing that. Our division was along the Leopold Canal, which was a formidable obstacle in that it was very deep. I can't remember how wide it was, but the Germans were deployed on the other side, the northeast side, in some considerable depth and well dug in and very difficult to get at. Now, if you can imagine trying to cross a waterway right like that, right in front of enemy positions, it's a pretty hairy business. So, again, I was sent up to do forward observer, and again with the Regina rifles. I seem to have spent a lot of time with the Reginas. And they tried to put two companies across, but only one made it, and it was the company I was with that made it. But when they got across, the only bridgehead they could hold was approximately 50 yards deep and about 200 yards long, which is very, very small. And you can imagine how much shelling the enemy did of that position, and the amount of firing we had to do, defensive fire, to try and keep the enemy out of there. Well, we did keep them out. The bridgehead was small, but it held. And that was the initial foothold across the Leopold Canal. Some considerable time later, 4 or 5 or maybe even 7 days later, I can't remember how many days, but it seemed like ages, other companies or other battalions got across and enlarged the bridgehead. And eventually that whole area of the Scheldt was cleaned out.
So you went across with this division? With this company?
Right, yeah.
In a rubber boat?
In a rubber boat.
During the day or the night?
Yeah, it was a night assault.
I see.
Right.
And you went across with two companies, but only one made it the other
way. Yeah, I was with the company that made it. There was another forward observer with the other company.
And you fought for 7 days.
Well, we went over there and held the bridgehead for 7 days. Yeah, we fought for 7 days. I think it was 7 days. Maybe it wasn't that long, but it certainly seemed that long. I can't remember exactly how long it was. But it seemed to go on and on before other Canadian troops could get across and give us some support.
And you were calling back and deploying your artillery fire?
I was calling artillery fire down most of the time, that's right. What I used, in effect, was what we call in the artillery stonks. And all that is a linear target. Instead of a concentration of shells like this, the shells are spread out in linear form. So that little bridgehead I had, or they had, the Reginas, I lined with linear targets all the way around. And as the enemy tried to attack on one side or the other, you just call for 10 rounds gunfire, scale 10, on any particular target which you thought would stop them. And I guess it was successful because we held the bridgehead. But it was a pretty scary time because, you know, you couldn't get an awful lot of sleep because the enemy didn't let up very much. So you're on duty there pretty well all the time, or wide awake all the time, trying to make sure the enemy didn't push you back.
Casualties were heavy?
Yes, the casualties were heavy, and the casualties would be evacuated in rubber boats back across the canal. But it was a tough fighting area because the ground was soggy and wet, and it was very difficult going. And that's why it sticks in my mind as likely one of the toughest areas we fought in. Well, then we spent some time there because it was hard going, and it took us a long time to clean out that pocket. And eventually, of course, I think it was another division went around the north and went out to the Breskens Peninsula, and Walcheren Island was flooded, and eventually the Germans had to withdraw, and the Scheldt was opened up, and the port of Antwerp was taken. The next big battle that took place, I guess, was the Operation Market Garden, which was the dropping of the paratroopers into Arnhem, and also dropping them into the other bridges south of there, Nijmegen and can't remember the third one. In any case, there were three bridges, and parachute troops dropped into each of the three. That was a rough battle. General Horrocks' 30 Corps was involved, of course, and we were part of 30 Corps, I believe, at that time. I'm not sure when we became part of 30 Corps, but I do remember that eventually, after we left the Scheldt estuary, we were ordered forward as part of the ground force to go up and try and reinforce the paratroopers. And in fact, we crossed the bridge at Nijmegen and actually deployed between Arnhem and Nijmegen in support of the paratroopers in Arnhem. Now, I couldn't possibly remember the name of the area in which we deployed, but I remember we moved in the dark, we deployed in the dark, we started firing in the dark. I'm not sure how long we stayed there, maybe 24 hours or 36, something like that. And then eventually we were ordered out and back across the Nijmegen Bridge.
When did you get an indication that the operation had gone sour and that the paratroopers had run into heavy opposition? Was that...
I guess it would be... I honestly can't remember. I'm not sure I ever knew, but I would, looking back in retrospect, I would say that when we were told to withdraw from the position between Nijmegen and Arnhem, that was the indication that the jig was up and that the paratroopers couldn't hold and that they couldn't make contact and that the paratroopers were going to have to come back. And this is when we were ordered out and back south again of Nijmegen, back across that Nijmegen Bridge.
Was that the first time you had to withdraw in action?
Yep. I think that's a true statement. Yeah, I think that's right. Mm-hmm.
What was the spirit of the troops there?
Well, I'm not sure, you see, at that stage, if they really knew what was going on, the troops on the guns I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if you're in an artillery unit, the officers know what's going on, but the men Oh, yes, you're supposed to brief them and keep them up to date as what's going on in the battle, and you do that as best you can when there's a bit of free time or a slack moment. But when the battle's hectic and heavy, there's no time to brief them in. And I would suggest at that stage, because we had traveled all night, we crossed the bridge at night, we deployed in darkness, I don't think they knew what the hell was going on, quite frankly. I'm not sure I did, to tell you the truth. I may have, but I can't remember. I suppose we knew there was some big operation going on, and we were obviously firing in support of it. But just what it was all about, we likely didn't know. Well, eventually the paratroopers were withdrawn out of it. They got out of Arnhem. And then winter came, and to get back to our own division now, we sat in the Nijmegen area most of the winter. And I remember it snowed pretty heavily that winter, and most people were pretty cold. I was living in a big hole in the ground, which we had dug out. Again, I was back at the battery. I wasn't with the infantry. And Christmas came and went. Nothing very exciting about it, just another day.
Was the fighting dropped down?
Oh, yeah, it was quiet then. Yeah.
All along the front?
Yeah, well, the Germans, you see, once the paratroopers withdrew, the Germans flooded the area north of Nijmegen, between Arnhem and Nijmegen, and that was all flooded. So there was little contact with the enemy on that side, that is, the north side of Nijmegen, to the east, in the Hochwald Forest and so on. There was contact there. But the enemy and ourselves, we were pretty well holed up. There was no action being taken. The Battle of the Bulge was going on to the south of us, you see, and some of the British troops were involved in that, but we weren't, none at all. We were simply in a holding position, waiting for what? Supplies, ammunition, etc., to come up until we started the next phase of the battle.
How was the supply, the lines at that time?
Fine, no problem.
There weren't any problems?
No. But the powers that be in their wisdom, you know, they had planned a full-scale battle with a thousand artillery pieces and a great huge bombardment by artillery before the troops went in the next phase of the battle, which was to the east of Nijmegen. So it takes time to build it up. Right. On the 31st of December, I found out that I was leaving the regiment, and I was promoted to major and posted across to the 14th Field Regiment, which was again part of the 3rd Division. So it was the same division, but a different regiment. And this was on the 31st of December, New Year's Eve. And I can remember going across and reporting to my CO. And he said, well, you're taking the 81st Battery. And I said, where's that from, sir? And he said, well, that's a French-Canadian battery from Shawinigan Falls. And I couldn't speak French at all. But it didn't seem to be that important. The officers I had were, there was one French-Canadian officer, and the rest were all English-speaking. Because, you know, after, what, 4 years, people get promoted and posted and changed. And although a lot of the gunners were French-speaking, and it was a battery from Shawinigan Falls, a lot of the people in it were bilingual, so there was no great problem. Orders were given in English, of course. And as a battery commander now, I was no longer spending time at the battery. My job was up supporting infantry again. And this, in this brigade, which was 9 Brigade, which in fact was General Rockingham's brigade, I was supporting the North Nova Scotia Highlanders.
Oh, yes.
Under Colonel Don Forbes was the commanding officer. Very fine fellow. So I can remember going over to the battery and taking command of the battery in a quiet period, assembling the troops and trying to speak to them in my English and broken French, and just giving them a pep talk and telling them how pleased I was to be here and that sort of thing. And then I went forward. And I didn't see very much of the battery then until the war ended, because this is the way it happens. If you're a forward observer or a battery commander, forward with the infantry, you very seldom get back to the battery unless it's a very quiet lull and you can get away for a couple hours. That doesn't happen often. You spend your life with the infantry, and that's, you eat with them and sleep with them and support them to the best of your ability, and that's the way it goes. But I do remember my CO wanted a week back at the regiment, my new CO. And as I was the newest recruit in the regiment, the newest battery commander, I was told I would go up to brigade headquarters for a week while my CO went back to the regiment and had a rest. Well, I went up and reported to the brigade, and I'd never met he was Brigadier then, Brigadier Rockingham before, but he was the brigade commander, and he's the fellow I worked for a week. But it was terribly quiet. There was nothing going on. Nobody was doing much firing. Maybe some harassing fire tests, but that sort of thing, but the enemy weren't attacking, and it was a very quiet period. And I spent a week there, and I can remember one day I was at the brigade headquarters, and this British officer came in, and in a very British voice, said, where can I find Brigadier Rockingham? So I talked to him briefly, and took him in to see General Brigadier Rockingham. And at that stage, I didn't realize who it was. I found out later it was General Horrocks, who was the 30th Corps commander. Well, we sat there until it was decided in early February that we'd make the breakout, and then the great bombardment started. So having joined the North Nova Scotia Highlanders as their supporting battery commander, I joined Colonel Don Forbes and his staff, and we sat on the east side of, east and southeast side of Nijmegen, and planned the attack, which was to go in through the Reichwald and Hochwald forests. But as far as the North Nova Scotia Highlanders were concerned, they were to be mounted in amphibious vehicles called buffaloes, which were to go along the north side of the attack. In fact, the whole 3rd Canadian Division was going in that direction. And we went through the, we were to go through the flooded area in these amphibious vehicles. When the attack did start after this heavy bombardment, artillery bombardment, we mounted in our amphibious vehicles and headed out to the flooded area. And there was very little opposition out there. In fact, I can't remember any opposition. The only incident I can remember is that the Buffalo, the amphibious vehicle that I was in, the engine broke, the motor broke down, and we were stranded out there for 24 hours before somebody came along and rescued us. And eventually I managed to catch up with the North Nova Scotia Highlanders again. But that sort of thing could be serious. If they had met any serious opposition, and I had to be left behind because of a breakdown, it would have been much more difficult for the Highlanders to obtain artillery support with no battery commander there.
Okay, so how many men did you have with you? Obviously, your radio
in the party?
Yeah. Just from the artillery?
Likely three men, if I remember correctly. Two radio operators and what we call a technical assistant, who works at computations, or technical gunnery computations. So there were likely four of us all told.
And you would call in the fire support and then what, spot the shell? And
well, the battery commander doesn't do much actual firing himself. He's not like a forward observer. The forward observer is right up in the very front line with the company, okay, and can actually see the enemy, the targets, and will engage them as such. A battery commander is back further at battalion headquarters, the infantry battalion headquarters, and his job is mainly that of an advisor and making up fire plans, not actually manning an observation post and engaging the enemy that he can see. That's the job of the forward observer. The battery commander is the artillery advisor to the battalion commander, will make up all the fire plans necessary for attack, and this he does on maps with protractors and so on. And the fire plans then sent back to the regiment, and they're computed in H-hour bang, the way they go. But the battery commander, like the forward observer, lives in the pocket of the infantry, and goes everywhere he goes, lives with them day and night, and handles all artillery aspects for the battalion command. So, after that incident of sitting out in the water for 24 hours, eventually we were hauled into shore, and eventually I found out where the battalion had gone, and we married up with the battalion. Now, the fighting down, there's an awful lot of hand-to-hand fighting that went on all the way through the Reich Wall and the Hawk Wall, and all the way down until we cleared out the enemy in the Wesel area. Wesel being on the other side of the Rhine, but just opposite Wesel. But there was some very, very heavy fighting, and some of the infantry units had some very rough times. I can remember the Essex Scottish Regiment, which I think was part of the 2nd Division. One of our units took over from the Essex Scottish in the line at one stage in those battles. And the Essex Scottish had had a very, very rough time, very heavy casualties. So the Germans, as you say, were now in Germany, and the Germans were fighting tooth and nail to hold as much of their own land or territory as they could. They weren't going to give up anything. So it was a long, drawn-out battle. We started there in early February, and I can't remember exactly when we finally cleaned out that pocket, that whole pocket down there, and cleaned them out far enough so that we could stop and plan our attack across the Rhine. But I would think it was April, likely. So that was 2 months of solid fighting to clean that out, and it was heavy going. Anyway, eventually, we succeeded. And then the build-up for the crossing of the Rhine, which involved many, many divisions, paratroopers, bombing, massive artillery bombardment. The largest artillery bombardment of World War II, as far as I know. That's the impression we were given. And all this took place, and eventually the Rhine was crossed south of Emmerich in the Wesel area. And the crossing wasn't as difficult as we thought it might be. It was crossed, and there was firing, and there was fighting, but it wasn't extremely heavy fighting. And eventually we wound our way up along the Rhine, and I can remember going through Emmerich, but not stopping in Emmerich, going through it and carrying on up close to the border between Germany and Holland and moving north. And then there were little skirmishes and small battles all the way up until eventually, of course, there was a ceasefire. There was nothing terribly exciting after we crossed the Rhine until the fighting ended and there was the ceasefire, and I was invited, or ordered, I should say, to go into Emmerich. I'm sorry, Emden, on the coast, and do a reconnaissance of the area of Emden, looking for large buildings for A, accommodation for troops, and B, equipment, and C, ammunition, and so on. And this was the start of settling down after the war ended. And I was ordered in. I went in with my driver in my Jeep, and it was very scary because just on the outskirts of Emden, on both sides of the road, there were all kinds of German soldiers who still had their weapons. The town had not been cleaned out, and they knew the war was over, but they could have very easily taken a pot shot at us as we drove along the road. Fortunately, they didn't. And we got into Emden and did our reconnaissance and got all the information I needed and eventually went back to the regiment. And as we left Emden, the soldiers were still there. So I consider myself fortunate in that nothing happened, and it could have happened very easily. And I guess no one would want to get killed after the war was over. So I went back to the regiment and submitted my report. And whether someone used Emden after the war was over, I don't really know. We didn't. Eventually we were moved back into Holland. And we moved to an area very close to Utrecht, which was south or southeast of Amsterdam. And there we stayed until eventually all the troops were returned home. And this took at least 6 months. I spent 6 months there. The 2IC of the regiment was sent home, and I was ordered to stay, although I had lots of points and thought I'd get home early, but I didn't. So I did second in command of the regiment for the 6 months when we were sitting there in Holland. And the difficult part was trying to keep the troops busy so they would stay out of trouble. And there wasn't an awful lot of training that went on because, well, the war was over. There were all kinds of sporting events, track and field meets, softball games, and this sort of thing. We organized parties and smokers and dances for the troops. We took them out on tours to cities like Amsterdam and showed them some of the countryside. But to sit there for 6 months and keep them out of trouble was pretty darn difficult. However, we had to do it, and it was done. I eventually was sent home in December, and I got home to Charlottetown just a week before Christmas, which was very nice.
You'd been out of Canada, what, almost 6 years?
Yes, the summer of 1940, well, just over 5 years, right? 5.5 years, yeah, that's right.
Well, then,
pardon?
Much of a change?
Yes, well, no, not where I went. You know, I landed in Halifax, and I'm a Maritimer. I was a Maritimer, and I went back to Charlottetown where my mother was, and my wife had arrived. And I didn't see much change in Charlottetown or Halifax. No, not really. But at the end of the war, you know, you then have to gather your thoughts together and say, well, now, am I going back to what I was doing before war broke out, or what am I going to do? And here you are, 5.5 or 6 years out of your life. Are you going to start university now at the age of almost 26? Well, what are you going to do? Before the war, I thought I'd like to be a chartered accountant. And I was going to Queen's University in Kingston to get my degree. But when war broke out, that ended that. So my assessment was that, and I discussed it with my wife when I got home, my assessment was that I would see what was offered in Charlottetown. And failing that, I would consider staying in the regular army because I enjoyed my 5 or 6 years in the forces. And my wife agreed. She thought it was likely a good thing for me. You know, I was a major 26 and things looked pretty rosy. So when I got to Charlottetown, I looked around and I was offered one job, which was assistant fire inspector for the whole of Prince Edward Island, which didn't pay an awful lot of money in those days, and I soon realized that there was only one promotion for the rest of my life, and that was from assistant fire inspector to fire inspector, and that's as far as I could go. So I decided that wasn't for me. So I then applied to stay in the regular, or join the regular army, and my commanding officer on D-Day, Colonel Webb by name, was commanding a regular force regiment in Petawawa after the war, and I had written to him and sounded him out, and he said, I would love to have you. If you decide you want to stay in, let me know, and I'll arrange to have you posted to my regiment.
Very nice.
So I decided to stay in. I was accepted, and I was, in fact, posted to his regiment in Petawawa as a battery commander. What they didn't tell me was that later, a year, in, say, September 46, when they reorganized the Canadian peacetime army, they had a surplus of senior officers, and some of us who were not regular force before the war were invited to a revert in rank, to a lower rank. And I considered myself lucky in that I was asked to revert only back to a captain, whereas some officers who got commissions during the war had to revert back to sergeants, for heaven's sake. So I accepted that, and I reverted back to a captain. And then the regiment was moved from Petawawa to Shiloh, Manitoba, with families, with belongings, a few belongings we had in those days. And away we went by train, the whole regiment, to Shiloh, Manitoba. And we arrived in Douglas, Manitoba, which is a little village, in the middle of the night, and the wives, I guess, didn't realize what they were getting into. It was just barren. It was a great artillery training center of Shiloh, Douglas being 10 miles from Shiloh, was pretty flat. And as we found out later, terribly cold in the winter. So it was pretty rough for some of the families, I think. And people like my own wife, who was English, had no idea what it was like in Manitoba in midwinter. So we soon found out. But I didn't stay there long. I didn't know it at the time, but my CO had recommended that I take a long gunnery staff course in England. And I was accepted for that, so we arrived in Shiloh, Manitoba, I guess in September, October, 46 I'm talking about now. And my family and I left for England in December, 46, so we only spent a couple of months out there, 2 or 3 months.
Thankfully.
Well, no, it didn't matter to me in those days. You know, I was anxious to learn. I wanted to learn as much as I could. I decided I was going to stay in the regulars, so if I was going to get ahead in life, I wanted to get on with my learning process. And this was a great opportunity to go to England and for 15 months and take a very long artillery course, gunnery course, and to come back a qualified instructor in gunnery, which I did.
I'm interested in what you had learned prior to D-Day regarding artillery, and then, of course, your long action throughout.
Prior to D-Day?
Well, you've been on all these courses, these artillery courses.
But they weren't all artillery courses. You see, some of them, for example, were a motorcycle course. Learn how to ride a motorcycle. Another one was camouflage and concealment, which I remember taking in Tunbridge Wells, and that taught you how to camouflage, conceal your guns or your vehicles or whatever in battle. And before we became self-propelled, I don't think I mentioned that, after we arrived in Normandy, they took away our self-propelled guns, which we had for the assault, the landing, and gave us back our towed guns. So in England, before D-Day, some of us took self-propelled artillery courses, and I was one. I went to Lark Hill for a couple of weeks, I guess, to learn something about self-propelled artillery, because it's quite different than ordinary towed field artillery.
Which do you prefer?
Oh, I don't know. I would think self-propelled, because although, self-propelled is not all jam, because if you're operating with self-propelled artillery and something goes wrong with the mechanism of the motor or the tracks on the vehicle, you've lost your gun. Whereas if you've got towed artillery and something goes wrong with the tractor that's towing the gun, all you do is unhitch the gun and hook it up to another vehicle and carry on. But with a self-propelled gun, if it goes out of something's wrong with it, you've lost the gun. You just can't get it there. I enjoyed self-propelled artillery. It was different. It was exciting. It's like being in a tank in many ways. It's mobile, and you're much more mobile than with towed. But it has its limitations, too. But yes, I took lots of courses, quite a number of courses.
Did the content of those courses change after the war? The lessons that have been learned?
No, not right after the war. No, they've changed now. Gosh, they've gone through many changes. But right after the war, when I went back to England on my course, no, it hadn't changed at all. There'd been no time. You know, the war had only been over a year and a half. So there were no great changes. And they were still sorting out all the lessons they had learned from the war and trying to put them into pamphlet form for future use. But in England in those days, the year 47, my gosh, it was grim. You'd wonder who won the war, because that particular winter, 46-47 over there, was one of the worst winters they'd ever had up to that time. And cold, bitterly cold, and there was no coal, there was no fuel. I can remember literally sitting listening to a lecture or sitting in my so-called quarters at night studying with my greatcoat on, because if you took it off, you'd nearly freeze to death. There was just no heat, and it was terrible. Must have been terribly discouraging for the British, who in theory had won the war, but here they were suffering like that. Anyway, it was a great opportunity, and 15 months of solid study and learning nothing but artillery, and it was tremendous. And then I was sent back to Canada with my family and right back to Shiloh, Manitoba, as an instructor in gunnery at the School of Artillery, which I thoroughly enjoyed instructing. I loved. I thought it was great fun. And I guess I spent 3 years there as an instructor, and I was still a captain, except in 1950, or late 49, I can't remember which. I went back there in 48, and I guess it was 49, we got a new chief instructor in gunnery, whose name was McNaughton, and this was General McNaughton's son, Teddy McNaughton, who later changed his name to Leslie and recently passed away of a heart attack as Colonel Commandant of the Artillery. Anyway, this was the first time I'd met Major McNaughton. And he became quite interested in me and wanted to know my history and why was I reverted back to a captain and how long had I been a captain the second time. And I said, well, it's in September 46. And he said, that's bloody nonsense. You shouldn't have lost your rank. Anyway, he got me my majority back again in February 1950. So I went back up to Major. February 15, continued instructing until I left the School of Artillery in 1951. During that time, I'd been down to Fort Sill, which is the artillery school in the United States, for a two-week conversion course because it had been decided that we'd no longer use British weapons, that we were going to buy American weapons. And so I was sent down with a team of instructors to take 2 weeks training on the American weapon system. Could use them when we got. So that's when we started first using American weapons.
Any great change quality or?
No, not really. Minor things, you know. The British sighting system was in degrees and minutes and seconds, and degrees and minutes mostly. Whereas the American systems were in mils, 6,400 mils in the circle, as opposed to 360 degrees. Minor things like that. It required a little bit of education. We were educated. No great problem. No. In 1951, I was posted from Shiloh, Manitoba to Ottawa, and this is the only time I've ever served in Ottawa. And I was only there 9 months. And I was posted to the Director of Artillery's office, and I was there 9 months. Pre-staff training, as it were, before I was sent to the staff college at the end of the year. So I worked as a major in that office for 9 months and learned something about staff work, and this was my first exposure ever to staff work. I'd been a field soldier up until then. And I enjoyed it, 9 months, and then I was posted to the staff college in Kingston, Ontario, Army Staff College, for a year's course. And that was great. I thoroughly enjoyed that. General Dextraz was a student on that same course. General Quinn was on that course. And a lot of our future generals were on that same course. And it was a bad year in that it was the year that the king had died, and there were no social activities going on at all because of that. And no, I'm incorrect. I'm so sorry. I'm wrong. There were no social activities because they were redoing the officers' mess at Fort Frontenac in Kingston. And they had to set up a temporary mess, so there were no big functions going on at all. So, socially, it was a rather dull year, but it gave you that much more time to study.
To study.
Yeah, right. Well, after 12 months in Kingston, I was posted to a new unit called the 81st Field Regiment, the 2nd in Command, in Petawawa. And this unit was training to go to Korea. And those were the days of Korea. And I knew how I got there. The CO of the regiment had asked for me. I'd been in his battery during the war. And he asked for me as his 2IC.
Who was this?
His name was Don Wilson. But before I ever got to the regiment, he got himself into some kind of trouble, the details of which we don't have to go into. And he lost command. And command was given to an artillery lieutenant colonel who happened to be instructor at the staff college. And I was still at the staff college when all this happened. So when I heard about all this, I asked for an appointment with the new CO. And I went in and said, now, I was posted this regiment is 2IC by your predecessor who knew me during the war, and you may have somebody else in mind. You may rather have somebody else as your 2IC. And he looked at me and he said, Jake, for heaven's sakes, he said, I'm a bird gunner, which means I'm an anti-aircraft artillery, basically. I'm a bird gunner. I'm not a field gunner. I don't know very much about field artillery. You're a qualified instructor in gunnery field. I need you. Now, are you prepared to serve me? And I said, of course. So we went on from there. And I joined the regiment in Petawawa, and we trained there for 3 months, I guess, and then the whole regiment went overseas to Korea. But the Korean situation had just about finished, and I think we had only been in Korea 3 months before, maybe four, before the armistice was signed, so we didn't see an awful lot of action. But after, I guess we saw enough action, and I got my MBE in Korea, so I guess we saw some action. And after the war was over, they set up this armistice commission, which is still in existence, and a lot of the nations who had troops fighting in Korea sent representatives to this armistice commission, and I was the second, the first Canadian representative, came out from Canada as a half-lieutenant colonel, and was the Canadian rep at it, but he only stayed 4 or 5 months, and then he was sent home, and I went down there as the Canadian rep, but I didn't get promoted out of it. I was the rep at the major.
Okay, we'll just have to take a pause there.
Okay.